Okay, folks, we're now back into business. And I'm sorry if you missed out on some of the last lecture because it stopped recording at some unknown point. But whatever is there. And now this is the next part of the session. And we're looking at page 403 in chapter 11. Those of you that aren't here at the lecture won't have got the handout, but it's the first four pages of the chapter, so you can easily find it. And we've just been discussing the way that Himmelfarb and Alf Dubbo, in their first meeting with each other, don't speak, and yet there's this kind of profound, silent relationship with them. And it seems that in silence, they seem to be deeply, in the way they comfort each other. How he went to meet his silence, how they would lay balm on wounds every time they passed each other. So Patrick White is here drawing attention to the ways in which these two outcast characters have some deep affinity with each other, even though no words are passed. So we're going to the next paragraph. It was ridiculous. They were both... Have you got the text in front of you there? You have.
Yeah,
it's on page 403. Where did you get that text from, by the way?
I bought it online from Book Depository.
Okay, that's great, because it's the one with David Maloof's introduction, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. They were both ashamed and turned their backs and resumed their waiting. That's where we stopped. Sometimes the abbo would whistle derisively, some pop tune he had learnt from the radio. He would blow out his lips to extend an already considerable vulgarity of theme. To destroy, it was suggested, but knew that his friend Old Big Nose would never be deceived. If we just look at that paragraph for a moment, the way that Patrick White tries to get inside the relationship between people. So the Aboriginal would whistle derisively, some pop tune, derisively, and then would blow out his lips to extend an already considerable vulgarity of theme of the pop song maybe. And then you've got Patrick White creating this one non-grammatical sentence, because it's not a complete idea, but it's to destroy, it was suggested. That's a typical Patrick White sentence that really kind of challenges people to what the hell is he talking about? But in the context, if you look at it closely, it does indicate something. But knew that his friend Old Big Nose, and where does that term come from, would never be deceived. Let's just see if we can manage or master this way of Patrick White's writing here. What's he saying about this moment between the two of them? They haven't talked. They turn their backs against each other. They resume their waiting. We're not sure what they're waiting for. And then the abbo suddenly whistles a pop tune and then deliberately blows out his lips to extend an already considerable vulgarity of theme. Do we know what this means? We got any idea, any suggestions? Rochelle, you haven't had a chance to talk yet.
I'm not really sure with this one.
It's difficult. It's the hardest one we've come up to so far.
Yeah, I have things to say about the other ones that I already said, but this one I don't know.
Yep. Any thought at all? What's the general drift you get here of what's happening between them? Is it hostility or friendship? Have a guess.
He is
Alf Dubbo, yep.
I feel like he's almost making noises and things to kind of communicate without directly communicating.
Something like that going on, you think? Yeah, that's interesting. Possibly. That's possibly, yeah, possible. And Suzanne, what would you like to add to Rochelle?
Sorry, I didn't know the exact paragraph.
We're in the middle of page 403. Bang in the middle.
It was ridiculous. Yeah, I was still kind of reading the previous one.
Yep. Okay, we skip you for the moment. We go to Joey. Yep.
It makes me think of wowzers.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, people who gain their own sense of pleasure from sort of limiting the joys of other people.
Okay. So you think the Abbo is doing this to Himmelfarb?
No, I just think that with words like derisively and the vulgarity of the music.
Yeah.
Patrick White is empathizing with these people that would just love to hurl judgment upon people's.
Who would hurl judgment? Who's hurling judgment?
Well, I feel that, you know, Patrick White would have come across people who would have been very dismissive of his.
Of Patrick White's?
Of Patrick White's literary skills.
Yep.
And
so is this Abbo fulfilling that sort of position of derisiveness or not?
Well, it's rather innocent, just like some guy humming or something. But some people would say, oh, you know, it's just another bloody Abbo not shutting up and...
So is it other people's points of view about the Abbo that's being reflected here, not the Abbo's point of view?
Yeah, that's what I feel.
Tara?
I might be completely off course, but I feel like, so isn't the Abbo, Edwards, whistling something he's heard from the radio, meaning popular Australian
yep.
music,
yep.
non-Indigenous?
Yep.
And then by going like yeah, that's real good, like criticising... What, like criticizing the whole of that society itself in saying like in that
yeah
but then the part where it gets to knew that his friend or big nose would never be deceived, I'm not sure about that, like would never be become a part of it, like I don't know, that last sentence is where I get thrown off course.
Yeah,
that idea, I'm not sure how that fits.
It's interesting, it's a very typically difficult Patrick White passage that turns some people off Patrick White because, you know, he sort of tries to get underneath the layers of what people are thinking and feeling and how they respond to each other. And sometimes, like everything we've read so far, we've got it. But here, it seems to take us into places that we don't quite get. What do you think, Claudia?
Yeah, I thought that was actually quite interesting with what you pointed out. I think with the last bit, but you that his friend or big nose would never be deceived, I thought that it was more, again, that mutual understanding,
yeah.
Non-verbal, that, you know, we're different, we won't fit in with that, like we won't be deceived. And also I think what Helena was saying before that as well, a little bit about, you know, like knowing that that person wouldn't just, like, do what the others would do, sort of thing.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, it's a bit of a tricky one too. I can't quite get it. But, like, then following from that, they might have left it at that after all, each in this time had experienced the knife. So it kind of just
reaffirms.
Yeah, reaffirms that.
They're outsiders.
Experienced hardship.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
What's your take on it?
Well, my take is that you know, sometimes the Abbo would whistle derisively some pop tune he'd learned. I don't think that the derisive is against Himmelfarb at all, but he's whistling a pop tune with some, rather like what you said, Tara, he's whistling it with some sort of disdain, like, you know, it's not his culture, and he's sort of doing what, you know, most factory workers would do, but he's doing it with a certain kind of distance, and he would blow out his lips to extend an already considerable vulgarity of theme. There's almost a sense that he's parodying what he's saying. To destroy it was suggested. Well, you know, if he pushed it further, he's actually parodying it so much that he's wanting to kind of really distance himself and destroy that manifestation. But knew that his friend old Big Nose would never be deceived. That's the bit that gets me a little bit. Himmelfarb never be deceived. Well, that's speaking to me. It comes back to, I think, what Claudia said, that Himmelfarb knows what's going on in Alf Dubbo. Himmelfarb can see the kind of dramatic antics of Alf Dubbo. There's something there that, you know, his old friend Big Nose is almost endearing in a way. It's a kind of endearment because, you know, Jews have very big noses. That's their characteristic. His old friend Big Nose would never be deceived. It's the kind of drama. It's dramatizing a little moment of interaction where, you know, they're both outside the framework of what other people do, but they're both accepting this about each other.
The other thing I thought with knew that his old friend Big Nose would never be deceived, the other possibility I thought was potentially that the deception is that he's kind of parodying this cultural norm.
Yeah.
But maybe the deception that he wouldn't be able to pull over Big Nose is that they both secretly, as much as they might be critical of it, want to be part of it, and they're not.
Oh, that's interesting.
He's parodying
that's right.
it, but he's also like going, okay, well, I'm aware of like what they do, but
yeah.
I'm not part of it.
So yeah. Yeah, that's right. Good. So it's a little bit like Himmelfarb's reaction to the whole question of mateship again. Something like that along those lines. Okay. They might have left it at that. After all, each in his time had experienced the knife. Now, we're actually coming to the bit that I really wanted to come to. We're coming to it now. Then one day, during Smoko, Himmelfarb had gone into the washroom. Maria, you pay good attention here. One day, during Smoko, Himmelfarb had gone into the washroom, of which the scribbled woodwork, sweating concrete, and stained porcelain had grown quite acceptable. There he sat. There he leant his head. And the introspective accents of a mumbling cistern and a drizzling tap ministered to his throbbing head. He often sat out Smoko in the washroom, which would remain deserted until work began. Why would the washroom remain deserted until work began? They don't. Yeah, they use it when they're on the clock. That's right. They don't use it when they're on the.
Break.
That's right.
Sorry, is the Smoko a smoking room?
Smoko is a toilet.
Oh.
A Smoko is a break.
Yeah, that's what we call it. As well. Do you want to go for a smoko?
That's right. That's a Smoko.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought.
It's like when 15-minute breaks at work.
We call it a smoko when everyone smoked.
And it wasn't in the toilet that you had the smoko, but he used to sit out in the washroom during his smoko, which would remain deserted until work began. He would sit perfectly still, but on this particular occasion his hand had touched the book someone had left open on the bench. It was only natural for Himmelfarb to read whatever print he set his eyes on. Now he began at once, with surprise flooding over him. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the ash, out of the midst thereof, as the colour of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. But it was no longer his own voice which the Jew heard above the soft babble of the cistern and the sharper drizzle of the tap. It was the voice of voices, thick and two-throaty, and desolating in its sense of continuity. It could have been the voice of the Cantor Katzmann, yet the voice no longer attempted to clothe the creatures themselves in allegorical splendor of Babylonian gold. They were dressed in the flesh of men, the pug of human gargoyles, the rather soapy skin, the pores of which had been enlarged by sweat, the mouth thinned by trial and error, the dead hair of the living human creatures blowing in the wind of circumstance. The Jew read or heard. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. in spite of which he knew from observing he could read by heart the veins of the hidden bodies. Let's stop there for a moment. Go back to then one day during Smoko, Himmelfarb had gone into the washroom of which the scribbled woodwork, sweating concrete and stained porcelain had grown quite acceptable. There he sat, there he leant his head, and the introspective accents of a mumbling cistern and a drizzling tap ministered to his throbbing head. What environment is Patrick White setting up for us here? Of what's important about this environment that Himmelfarb is sitting in?
It's very like, not oppressive. I wouldn't say it's oppressive. I mean, it would just be like really, it lacks imagination.
Yeah, completely. Completely devoid of any sort of stimulus that could give any imagination. A bit like the description of where he was sitting and couldn't see the river in the first part. This is the environment that he inhabits. Scribbled woodwork, sweating concrete, stained porcelain. Why had it grown quite acceptable? Why? Why had this environment grown quite acceptable for Himmelfarb? Aileen, any thought?
Maybe he became just used to it.
Maybe he became just used to it.
Maybe it's because he's never really looked at to an environment for inspiration.
Yep.
And maybe it's just he's used to not relying on
external stimulus.
Yeah. I mean, he did. I was just going to add to what she was saying. He did also come from like a country that was going to the war and stuff. So I think any place he has come from, besides maybe his childhood. Lacks that imagination, that sort of like environment.
That's why he's capable of just accepting that environment.
Yeah.
Claudia?
Oh, I don't know if it's reading too much into it, but like again with the Holocaust and the Final Solution, how they actually like the Jews were forced to like go believe that they were going to go have a shower kind of thing in those washrooms. May have been because when I was reading, he wasn't
put into that.
Room. He had to like clean the rooms after everything had happened.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that became
part of what he accepted.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like that's too kind of horrific to kind of accept. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know.
What about the fact that he leant his head there, sat there, and the introspective accents of a mumbling cistern and a drizzling tap ministered to his throbbing head? Why is Patrick White drawing attention to the mumbling cistern, the drizzling tap, and the fact that these things administered to his throbbing head? What's going on there? Rochelle, any thoughts?
No, the only thing I get from this is just that he accepts it, like, for just for what it is, because he's used to it.
Yeah, go, Maria.
I mean, I think there's so many, all these things happening at once. I feel like he is a type of character. He's very, obviously, he's intellectual and all that. But I also think that all these things at once, he's confused. I feel like he's a bit of a confused character at the same time. Like, I don't know, maybe not the right word to use, but he doesn't really,
I feel like when it says all those things ministered to his throbbing head, it might be something that's just accumulated over time. So experiencing something similar to this environment before, it's kind of like the numbing of his mind. And I think this is just adding to that.
I mean, him always constantly in this environment.
Yeah.
And just, I think it's just kind of creating a bit of a, like an internal sort of conflict.
Go, please, Yatara.
I'm getting the sense, just overall, that he's just quite dispassionate about everything. Like, even when he's, like, earlier when he's kind of trying to be a good person,
yeah,
and then not wanting the attention. I don't know, it's like this, I don't know how to articulate the exact word that I'm thinking of, but there are people like that just go through the motions and just become, whether it's for a reason or whether that's just the way that they are, that they become just a part of the decor. And just
it's also what they're looking for. It's also, you know, I mean, I can actually relate to this. I remember teaching at school and being kind of really freaked out by all the other teachers and what they were going on about and so on. And I used to just like to go and stand down in the sports field away from everybody else and look up at the trees. I couldn't stand all that stuff that was going on, all that politics, all that argument about this, that and the other. A certain quest for some kind of interior freedom, which ironically he gets in the bloody washroom where, you know, there's scribbled woodwork, sweating concrete, but the only reason he gets it there is because no one else is there, because they're all out having a smoko. As it says in the next paragraph, he often sat out smoko in the washroom, which would remain deserted until work began. He would sit perfectly still, but on this particular occasion his hand touched the book someone had left open on the bench. And then something else happens. What else happens? It was only natural for Himmelfarb to read whatever print he set his eyes on. What print does he set his eyes on? Now he began at once, with surprise flooding over him.
Don't you answer the Bible? Ooh.
And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself. And a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the colour of amber out of the midst of the fire. But listen, Maria, how does the language of this passage, whether it's the Bible or not, doesn't matter, how does the language of this passage, how does it emerge in contrast to the environment in which Himmelfarb is sitting?
Oh, like there's a light to it. It's basically...
There's a light to it.
Yeah.
What sort of light?
A divine light.
Like, how do you know that? I thought you never read the Bible.
I mean, like, it's basically, well, it just makes you feel, when you're reading it, it makes you feel quite, it's kind of like, not hopeful, but I mean, it gives you a different sort of feeling.
Is it
compared
uplifting?
To, quite up, yeah, I would say it's quite uplifting. Like, you feel happy for...
Himmelfarb.
Like, you feel like there's something
else.
There's something else for him, because he obviously he's going, like, he's in his environment, he's not happy.
Yep.
So I think, yeah, I just feel quite happy for him.
Very good. Tara, you want to add to that?
Well, I think that's where I kind of got in the stark,
the starkness.
The starkness of the washroom, and when you're sitting there with this.
And the sound of the cistern.
Dispassionate.
Yeah.
As opposed to now, there's like, it begins to be this passionate moment that I kind of get from the description of the colours and enthusiasm and, you know, the brightness, amber, the midst of the fire. Fire suggests, if nothing else, apart from the passion, that it's action at least.
That's right.
It's a burning sensation that something is happening. So it's sort of giving some motion to this whole...
Yeah. Okay. Good. Did you want to add something, Claudia?
No, but...
Okay, so what I want to do now, because we're running out of time, we've got a page and a half, I want to read to the end of this section, and then we'll have some comments on what we think has actually happened in this little process, because there's a little drama that unfolds itself here. And it's very closely connected to the title of the novel, The Riders in the Chariot, because as you may or may not remember from the first lecture, The Riders in the Chariot actually refers to a description in the Old Testament in the book of Ezekiel, where Ezekiel the prophet, he has this vision of a chariot coming from heaven with four riders in it. And that's where Patrick White builds his whole novel around this idea. So we read from the top of the page. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four... And I want you to listen to the differences in language that come through in this page and a half. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. But it was no longer his own voice which the Jew heard above the soft babble of the cistern and the sharper drizzle of the tap. It was the voice of voices, thick and too throaty and desolating in its sense of continuity. It could have been the voice of the Cantor Katzman. That's the minister, the Jewish minister that Mordecai knew back home in Germany. Yet the voice no longer attempted to clothe the creatures themselves in allegorical splendor of Babylonian gold. Because, you know, when preachers stand up in church, they want to make their voice sound more sonorous because they want to try and give dignity to what they're reading. Here's something different happening. Yet the voice no longer attempted to clothe the creatures themselves in allegorical splendor of Babylonian gold. They were dressed in the flesh of men. The pug of human gargoyles, the rather soapy skin, the pores of which have been enlarged by sweat, the mouth thinned by trial and error, the dead hair of the living human creatures blowing in the wind of circumstance. The Jew read or heard, two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. In spite of which he knew from observing, he could read by heart the veins of the hidden bodies. Now the lips of the past blew the words a little faster, as if the mouth had adapted itself to the acceleration of time. Time, in fact, was almost up. Belts were tightening the machinery. Down in the workshop there was a thwack of leather, metal easing greasily. But the reader could not interrupt his reading. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. When the machinery in the workshop started up, the whole washroom revolted, but soon drowned and floated gently enough. Against the noise from the machines, the voices of the tap and cistern were no longer audible. But the voice of the Jew continued reading, now utterly his own and loud above the natter of the rejuvenated machines. And the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creatures was as the color of the terrible crystal stretched farther over the heads above. When the abbot came in, looking for something he'd left, immediately on seeing how he was caught, he remained poised, rocking on the balls of his normally flat and squelchy feet. He could not decide what to do. The Jew was shining. "It is Ezekiel," he said, forgetful of that convention by which he and the blackfellow refrained from exchanging words. "Somebody is reading Ezekiel. I found here, open on the bench." The spit jumped out of his mouth with a joy. The blackfellow stood there playing with a ball of cotton waste, backwards and forwards from hand to hand. He was sulking now, though. "It is your book?" asked the Jew. Then the blackfellow did something extraordinary. He spoke. "Yes," he admitted, "it's my book." "Then you read the Bible? What about the other prophets, Daniel, Ezra, Hosea?" The same unmanageable enthusiasm drove the Jew to ask. But it did not appear as though the blackfellow would allow himself to be trapped again. His lips were very thick and surly. He said, "We better go down now," and jerked his head in the direction of the workshop. "Yes," agreed the Jew. The abbot quickly took the book and hid it amongst what was apparently a bundle of his private belongings. Himmelfarb remained spellbound. He was smiling that slow inward smile which could exasperate those whom it excluded. "Interesting," he had to remark. "But I shall not ask any questions, as I see you do not wish me to." "Where'll it lead?" the abbot shrugged. "I was reared by a parson bloke. That's all. Sometimes I've read of the Bible, but not for any of his reasons. I read it because you can see it all, and it passes the time." All of which the abbo spoke in a curiously unexpected voice, conjured up from a considerable depth. After that, the two men returned to their work, for the machines were deriding them as they belted hell out of Rose Tree's shed. Now the Jew began to wonder as he sat at his drill and stamped the sheet and stamped the sheet, whether their relationship would be in any way altered by what had happened. But it did not appear to be. It was as though it had set too long in the form it had originally taken. A certain enduring warmth established in the beginning had perhaps been intensified. The Jew was conscious of it if ever the blackfellow passed. Something almost tactile took place between them, but scarcely ever again was there any exchange of words. Sometimes the younger man would almost grunt. Sometimes the older one would almost nod. Or they would look for each other, even catch each other at it. And once the blackfellow smiled, not for his acquaintance of elaborate standing, but for anyone who cared to receive it. If the Jew did, that was incidental. It was, the latter saw, a demonstration of perfect detachment. Yet Himmelfarb was heartened by his study of this other living creature, to whom he had become joined extraordinarily by silence and perhaps also by dedication. On one other occasion, finding they had arrived simultaneously at the outer gate and there was no avoiding it, they must go out together. He could not resist addressing the black. "Zadavi spoke," the Jew ventured. "Either I did not think or have the time to ask your name." The abbo could have been preparing to sulk, but changed his mind quickly, it appeared, on sensing there was no trap. "Dubbo," he answered briskly, "Alf Dubbo," and as briskly went off. He was gay on that day, I think this is Himmelfarb. He picked up a stone and made it skip along the surface of the green river. He stood for a moment squinting at the sun, the light from which splintered on his broad teeth. He could have been smiling, but that was more probably the light concentrated on the planes of his excellent teeth. Wow, it's a lot going on. This is like a whole little play being enacted here between these two people. This is why this book is 639 pages long, because Patrick White really gets into every situation. So what's going on here? Let's have a little bit of time to kind of just discuss our sense of what's happening between these two characters. Everybody tell me something. Let's start with Joey and go around anti-clockwise. Don't have to read it again. Just speak from what you heard.
Yeah. I don't really know. There seems to be a lot happening and also nothing happening. So he's read a book. Granted, it's very meaningful for his Jewish tradition. There's this connection that's been made.
That's the most important thing. Bottom of page 406. Yet Himmelfarb was heartened by his study of this other living creature. You know, Ezekiel's chariot is talked about as having four living creatures on it, and Claudia's laughing now. Why are you laughing?
Because that was going to be my comment.
Well, go and tell us now.
I was going to say, well, that's what stood out to me the most, is it's almost this connection and this joining, and he's just realised that he's a part of this chariot, and so is Alf. They make up this extraordinary vision.
So just pause there for a minute, because this is really interesting from the point of view of Patrick White as the novelist. Imagine you're the novelist and you're writing a novel in the 20th century and you're wanting to write a novel that's kind of linking modern Australian life up with some biblical event, Maria, linking modern life with some biblical event, some symbolic event, but you don't want to distract or you don't want to alienate your readership by talking about some kind of absurdly realistic symbolic event. You want somehow the significance of this relationship, these relationships, to be evoked subtly. You want them to be presented in a way that readers can accept that something's happened here. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What did I say?
It's not as obvious as we pointed,
Not as obvious as you were pointing it out.
Yeah, that it's just, though, reiterating this immense connection between the two characters.
That's right, and yeah.
Yeah?
That's good. And there's something I want to add to that, but I won't add till we've all finished. Go, please, Aileen. Subversive. Go on, be subversive.
I think it was the last page or the page before that one, how there was, what we didn't call it relationship, but you could tell that there was something between the two characters.
Yeah.
And I think that it's kind of interesting how something like the Bible kind of brought them to words.
Amazing.
One another.
That's right.
And how we were talking about how the washroom was just this empty sort of
dead environment.
Yeah. And then it's like the Bible was the light. It's sort of like...
That's right. The Bible was the light.
It's sort of like the Jew. It's like how you said, trying to find inspiration away from everyone else.
Yep.
It's like he sort of found it with Alf.
He did. Through the Bible, through Alf's copy of the Bible. He found that inspiration through the Bible. That's right. And Himmelfarb himself becoming so emotionally attached to the language of the Bible and remembering his own past and his own connection with his tradition when he had his preacher reading these things in his Jewish ceremonies back in Germany, becoming so alive. Go on.
And before, how they were both reluctant to just speak words to each other. Now he's asking Alf so many questions.
That's right.
And it's what else would have triggered him to do that before?
That's right. And the other interesting thing out of what you've said is Alf Dubbo's connection with it is slightly different to Himmelfarb's. Yeah. What's the difference?
Alf Dubbo just says that, I just read it sometimes to pass the time.
Not only to pass the time. It's a very important phrase he uses. He says, it passes the time. I read it because you can see it all.
Yeah. That's what I...
Now, Maria, what does he mean by that?
You can see... I think when he says you can see it all, I think he's just saying that you can see beyond what is in front of you, beyond what your environment, what people look at you as, or
certainly.
Yeah, and I don't think he's just reading it to pass time.
You don't think he is?
No. I don't.
That's sort of like a dismissive comment. He doesn't want to be seen as someone who's, too...
He doesn't want to show his...
He's realised he's given away too much. Yeah. Pull myself back. I'm not that into it.
I'm not that into it. But, there's another aspect, Maria, to what you said, and that is that I think you're right when you say to see it all can mean that you see so much more of everything in it, like the whole universe. Something opens up when you read it.
Yeah.
But there's another thing more literal than that. You see it all when you read it. I don't know if you haven't read the Bible, so you wouldn't know this. But when you read the Bible, sometimes you can read something and there's an amazing clarity and visual quality in it. I mean, why have artists for the last 2,000 years, 4,000 years, found the Bible so continually a source of visual representation? It's like it's a trigger for the imagination.
Yep.
See it all. So it's got that aspect to it as well.
Yep.
Good. So Tara, last but not least, you've got 1 minute.
Okay, so I got that, what we just talked about was my main thing, but then I also liked the drawing back to reality by the, but also juxtaposition there of that the machines were riding them as they belted hell out of rose trees.
That's right.
The fact that it's hell, is really
symbolically interesting.
They're being brought back to reality from this, it may not quite be heavenly, but it's biblical.
Yeah.
Their imaginations have just sort of they've built that connection from where their minds have been able to go to another
place.
Almost divine place.
Yeah.
And then
quickly drawn back by the hell that's being belted out of the reality
that's both right. That's right.
Also living.
That's
so
right.
That was really interesting way of going now back to where we are.
That's right. And that's Patrick White's genius to kind of make the environment, you know, kind of such a competing element in this imaginative, highly symbolic moment where Himmelfarb and Alf Dubbo come together. And just to add to what you were going to say, Aileen, that the thing, when you read into this book now, what we get to know is that whereas Mordecai's got this kind of theological and mystical relationship to the text, Alf Dubbo's got this artistic relation. And Alf Dubbo turns these readings into paintings. And Patrick White has got this amazing gift to, through words, to show us what Alf Dubbo's paintings look like, but also to show us how Alf Dubbo's whole inner life is transformed by his act of trying to turn these words into paint. Yeah, and Patrick White, sorry?
The bard, like I was just thinking the word bard.
Yeah, he's like a bard. Alf Dubbo is like the bard.
Yeah.
And Patrick White himself often said that he was a frustrated painter. And you know, one of the things that when we went to the art gallery, we went into that print room. When I was there last year, I was told, because I was talking about this to the curator there, they said, did you know that Patrick White left his collection of some 400 valuable paintings to the gallery? And sometimes they're on show. Patrick White was a great collector of the visual arts. And, you know, many of his novels have got descriptions of paintings in them. And in this book here, he takes an Aboriginal and shows how Alf Dubbo has got this amazing visual gift, which some people have said is actually an attempt maybe to present Alf Dubbo as the original Aboriginal William Blake.
Okay.
Yeah, Aboriginal William Blake. There's been talk of that. And of course the novel begins with this quote from William Blake. So where is Ezekiel and Isaiah if it's not in Alf Dubbo's paintings?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's an amazing kind of leap for Patrick White. Patrick White is an Australian outsider artist to dare to take an Aboriginal off the street and turn an Aboriginal into a William Blake-like character for Australia. Amazing. Because you see, Alf Dubbo's paintings are often paintings that are profoundly spiritual. They're of Ezekiel. They're also of Jesus. And into those paintings, Alf Dubbo weaves Australian imagery. As you'll see, describes possums and, you know, sugar gliders. And
sorry, there was an interesting part a bit further into the chapter where the lady and the pastor that are looking after him, and he like does this extraordinary painting of his life.
Yeah.
He looks at it in horror and she's like, "What is that?" And he's like, "That's my life." And I'm like, "Oh, that's like alchemy."
That's right,
yeah,
exactly.
Like, it's almost like Brett White. Like,
that's right, it's almost like Brett Whiteley.
Like, okay,
that's right.
It's also interesting, like, we're talking about the, like, Alf Dubbo kind of being a part of a society which he's also not a part of.
That's right.
And Blake was like that.
That's
like
right, absolutely.
He was in his,
yeah,
you know, London,
yeah,
sort of living lifestyle, but
yeah,
that didn't mean that he agreed with it.
That's
that
right.
That didn't mean that he liked it.
No, that's
it was
right.
Against the sort of constitution and societal norms.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
As this character is.
As this character is. As William, as Patrick White is, absolutely. And the connection with alchemy is really interesting. I mean, Patrick White was a close friend of Brett Whiteley's.
Yeah.
He was in there, you know that, we saw that. So, but Brett Whiteley's life was not like Patrick White's, and certainly not like Alf Dubbo's. Brett Whiteley was up there, he was a superstar, and that's what killed him. Brett Whiteley couldn't really handle. Well, it's not what killed him, but it's sort of possibly part of his whole context. And it must be very difficult to be an artist and to become famous as an artist. Blake didn't suffer that. Blake didn't have the pocket, you know, maybe he would have liked to, but it didn't happen for him.
Yeah, he was kind of disregarded for a few decades, was
he? Well, yeah, more than a few decades. I think maybe, you know, half a century almost.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, folks, that's now 5-2, so we've gone over time. I should be asking for overtime. And you have a good weekend.
Same to you.
But I think that was good to do that reading of that section of the chapter.
No, it was. That was really helpful.
Yeah.
That's good. And you were all very insightful too, so thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
See you later. See Maria. See Aileen of the desert.
Hi, Claudia.
See you, Claudia. See you, Joey. You got a good weekend planned? Or a heavy work weekend planned?
I've got a bit of study to do.
Bit of study to do. Just a little.
Yeah.
Couple of essays to write. Couple of blogs to write.
Blogs, yeah. Thanks for the reminder.
Yes. I'll be putting